Hello, I'm Helen Small, and I'm in conversation this morning with my colleague Bart Van Es. And we've taken as our subject Hilary Mantel's trio of novels about Thomas Cromwell. And the particular subject for the day is something that interests us, that I think we both like, Bart, is that right? But that we know vexes a lot of people, and that is the use of the third person, he, instead of what might be a more natural way of telling the story for many people, which would be to deliver it in the first person, I. So Bart, over to you.
Yeah, I love this thing that Hilary Mantel has achieved. It allows us to kind of live inside Cromwell's head, but also at the same time to see this world in this much more kind of comprehensive and visual way than I've seen any kind of historical novelist do before. So the passage I've taken comes from very early on in the very first of these novels. It's the moment where, for the first time, we see Cromwell as an establishment figure. We've seen him before this as a boy being beaten around the blacksmith's yard by his father. And now we get this picture of him as urbane, of fitting into this world of power and privilege and rivalry. And the way in which the voice pictures other people, I think it gives us that sense of Cromwell's own wit and cynicism and power. So right in the first paragraph here, which I could very briefly quote, the chapter Paternity begins, "So, Stephen Gardner, going out as he's coming in. It's wet, and for a night in April, unseasonably warm. But Gardner wears furs, which look like oily and dense black feathers. He stands now, ruffling them, gathering his clothes about his tall, straight person, like black angel's wings. Late, Master Stephen says unpleasantly. He is bland. Me, or your good self?" And there's so much in that. I mean, there's a kind of allegorical force to that idea of the black angel's wings. We get all the time she's so good at giving this material quality to this world where clothes are very important. Those oily feathers kind of sum up Stephen's oiliness. And just that, the conversation is also great. It's just about archaic enough to feel like we're in the 16th century, but it's also just so powerfully witty and current. And all of that, I think, is possible because of this narrative voice that Mantel has created.
And it's odd, isn't it? Because it's witty when, if you take the materials just by themselves, what's actually happening? It's threatening. I mean, these are two thuggish men, and the rivalry between them has a lot to do with class, right? But also just to do with this bulk sense that the politics of the period is unforgiving, brutal, and if you take your eye off, you're an advantage, you've had it. So the use of humour in that context is unexpected in many ways.
Yes. I mean, she makes conversation compelling, which is, again, not what we really expect of a historical novel. And it's all the time about that micro positioning, that they're both actually figures with a relatively less than distinguished background as families. And then actually when we get the cardinal come in later, that's another figure. So this way in which the past is always kind of intruding on current exchanges, I think is also very important. So the idea that kind of Gardner is a blow-in with some dubious royal connection, and Cromwell's completely unusual in this world in having no pretensions about his background. So I think one of the reasons why he works so well as a focaliser, somebody we do kind of fall in love with, however manipulative he may be, he's someone who doesn't quite buy into the pretensions of his age. And that that cleverness of his point of view always, I think, allows us to kind of root for him at some level.
That's right. Now, people who don't like the he, one of the things that they say about the third person is that it can create grammatical ambiguity that isn't helpful. In other words, you're not quite sure who's being talked about. But this is a really good example, isn't it, where that kind of momentary, you're not sure who it applies to, is really doing something meaningful as well. Yeah?
Yeah, very often you do have to flick back sometimes and think, yeah, who's saying this. I think it partly gives that sense of overheard conversation and the paranoia of that world, that you don't quite know who's saying what ever. So it's too simple to say this is just focalized through Cromwell. Some of the time, you're much more a kind of fly on the wall type figure.
So in the bit that you just read, late, Master Stephen says unpleasantly, he is bland. In a more standard piece of narrative, that he would apply to Master Stephen, it's what we call the relevance criterion. So the he goes back to the last named person. But the he here, one becomes used to reading it, is Cromwell. And what you get is that battle to take over the control of who's in that position, who's the relevant subject, right?
Yeah, this very odd tick that she has, possibly she does overuse it a little, is the he, Cromwell, point, because she's never willing to give us that narrative certainty, particularly as far as kind of her central protagonist is concerned.
And there's a lot of precarity in that as well, isn't there? I mean, you get the sense these two tough guys, not going to budge for each other, but also the idea that they could be dislodged, either of them, at any point.
Yeah. Just later on in this passage, jumping on to the engagement with the cardinal, I love the way that she will sometimes just report kind of implied speech. So the cardinal comes in, or he comes into the cardinal space. Suddenly the world feels very different. You've seen these figures rain-covered. Now they're in this comfortable study. The cardinal writing says without looking up, "Thomas, still raining, I expected you earlier. Boatman, river, saint." You hear the same explanation, but in a slightly different way from what we've just heard it in that conversation with Gardner. Again, the wit is there, I think. I mean, I love Mantell's punctuation, simply.
Yeah.
She's really adventurous in using colons, semicolons, single word sentences.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Because it's a pugilistic mind, but it's also a really nimble mind that you're inside. So you could read the boatman river saint as bloody hell, what has it taken to get here? But you can also read it as a kind of funny chronology of the river and what it means to go up the river, and that will be a set of things that will keep coming back in the story and give it an underpinning elegance to its construction.
I mean, the combination of the pugilist and the theorist and the wit is really what kind of drives the story.
And it makes him really likable, as you said at the beginning, which is problematic, isn't it? Because if you look at what this man does in the course of the three novels, it's brutal. It really is savage, much of what he does. And it becomes gradually more apparent as you go through the three novels that he is a source of fear. Stephen Gardner can stand against him as someone who can take him on, but not everybody can do that. And there are certain scenes where, having been so much inside the head of this person, inside that he, one is made to realise what it is like to confront him as someone much, much more threatening. So I wonder if we could have a look at one of the later passages where there's still some wit, but something much more dangerous going on. So the second passage we're treating is in the third novel, about three quarters of the way through, where Cromwell goes to the Tower of London to visit Gertrude Courtney, who is the widow of the of Lord Exeter, who has just been executed largely through the machinations of Thomas Cromwell. She's in the tower. She has no good reason to think that she will be allowed to live. But it's a kind of... It's a very odd space, this apartment in the tower, which is a little bit like a normal reception room in which one can have tea, or in this case, eat almonds together and chat. Yeah. And you get that characteristic combination in Cromwell of considerable courtesy. He's wonderful facility in languages. And one thing that's said repeatedly of him is that he's very good at talking to women. But of course, his presence is hugely threatening. The question is, are you going to kill me, as you've already effectively killed Anne Boleyn? So like you, I'll read a bit, and then maybe we could talk about the change in what that he does here. He limps along to the tower, where in a broad and pleasant room, a pale fire in the hearth, he converses with Gertrude, Courtney's widow. For a woman who has just lost her husband to the headsman, she is self-possessed, dry-eyed, and eating almonds from a platter. "No doubt you fortified yourself with prayer," he says. "You cannot have been surprised. You knew everything my Lord Exeter said and did against the king. You were in his inner councils." "A woman has her own soul to save," Gertrude says. "Her husband will not do it for her. Did you know the traitor Pole is now in Spain?" She offers him an almond. "Why would I know? He is with the emperor, urging a crusade against his native land. Then he will go to France again, urging the same. So he turns about and about, snared in his treason." Her gaze drifts over his shoulder as if the wall is more interesting. I won't read it all. We'll put the text up on the screen so people can see the whole thing. But you have a curious passage in which there is huge threat to her. So there's considerable political machination going on behind here. She's someone who has close contacts with the Spanish. Her own stepmother was one of Catherine of Aragon's first ladies-in-waiting. So the implicit threat to her from him is, you've got contacts in Spain, you're part of this treacherous activity that's going on the outskirts, you know, outside Britain, and in danger of coming back and upsetting the entire Reformation project. And really what becomes apparent is that she is afraid that he is looking to trade her for Thomas Wyatt, the ambassador in Britain. And so will she be saved on those grounds? She thinks they're too slim, or will she go to the scaffold like Anne Boleyn before her? So you see someone who is hugely threatening, not least because this is a woman with very little of the power that he commands as the king's right-hand man. And there he is as this person, consistently courteous, charming, eating the almonds, and yet everything that he does, everything he says, has in it the knowledge that could kill or not kill as he decides. How do you think it is that Hilary Mantel can keep us so on side with someone so malicious from another angle? It would be possible to write him as a yeah. much, much darker character. And do you think it has something to do with this third person?
It does. I think it's also because that third person becomes increasingly kind of burdened with memory. So there's a kind of reworking in his own mind. The trial of Anne Boleyn actually plays out much more in book two than it does in book one, where it theoretically occurs in the chronology. And this very striking, again, to some people rather frustrating quality of the book is that you often don't really know where you are in time. I mean, a bit further on in the passage you chose, I think this is really a stunning example. Where we're told he is tortured. She doesn't see the other man whom he keeps short chained to the wall, the man for whom the work of forgetting is strenuous, who dreams of dungeons, cavities, and oubliettes. Such men are subject to uprushes of fear which wake them in the night. When they are frightened, they laugh. This is very curious because it seems to be Cromwell who is suffering under these terrible things that he has done.
Precisely. And one of the things it tells you is that one way in which he controls himself and his own suffering is by turning himself into a third person inside his own head. So that he is doing something protective. It's the man who would be afraid, the man who has too much to do with something that's just like the Spanish Inquisition, only on his own ground, deals with it by pretending not to be that person.
Yeah, he is short-chained himself here. And it's very interesting how different I think his speech is in this third book. I think you'd never find quite such a preachy Cromwell in the first two books, where now he's saying, he's using these words like traitor. He really has tried to restrain himself from ever using those terms until we get into this final phase when clearly threats are coming towards him, where the whole culture of paranoia and cruelty around Henry VIII has changed so much. So it's this internal development in the protagonist that is also very brilliantly figured through that free and direct way in which we see the he protagonist.
That's right. The element of humour that is saving in the first book, and well, throughout really, it is still there, isn't it? I mean, I don't know about you, I find the limping very funny, the paralleling, it's a historical fact, but it's beautifully played, at least. I believe it's a historical fact that he starts to imitate the king in his weakness, but also therefore to become really unpleasantly meshed with the volatility in the king's temperament. You know, what is the king going to do? Are you going to be up today or down? Are you in or out?
It's always a key part of it here. In the passage I chose, we get Wolsey demanding cherries in April. Yeah. And this is a very key part of the way that sort of Wolsey pretends that he's somehow suffering all the time. And so many interactions that are important to Cromwell involve food.
Yeah.
These endless meetings with the Spanish ambassador over kind of wonderful sort of Italian ravioli and things.
Yeah.
And all the time, food is part of power. And her offering him the almond here, I think, is a wonderful moment, a kind of you know, female empowerment versus Cromwell. It's a very daring thing for her to do.
That minimal retention. The other daring thing she does is actually to name what he is. So the extraordinary moment when he asks her the question. So she thinks that he is threatening, that he has already actually killed off or is about to kill off Bess Darrell, who she doesn't know has been persuaded by Cromwell to turn evidence against her. And when he answers, she is in a happier place. Gertrude's hand flies to her throat. God forgive you, you have not killed her. Do you think I am a brute? He is interested in her answer. She says, I have wondered why I am still alive myself. They say you do not like killing women, but you killed Anne Boleyn. I mean, for someone who's come so low and whose own life is so perilous, to name what he is a really dangerous moment. There are other moments, there are very threatening ones, like Norfolk, who names what is done, and Gardiner himself names what is done at various points of threat. But for the woman to do it from a position of weakness has a different effect. And her grammar is fascinating, isn't it? It's not quite clear when it says he is interested in her answer. It's not quite clear whether that comes before the answer or whether that's a reflection on the answer she's given. So is that him wondering what is she going to say, or is it him, this is what she said? I'm fascinated by that. Why would she call me a brute?
No, that's very interesting, isn't it? Also implies that he isn't very interested in any of the earlier things.
Yeah, exactly. Although, just don't you think it's a striking thing about Mantell? I don't think she ever writes a stupid woman. And more than that, you could put more strongly, nearly all her women are extremely intelligent because they kind of have to be.
Yeah, I think, again, that's another triumph of the series, because there are these obvious pitfalls. You know, on the one hand, you could make kind of anachronistically active women in this world where, you know, the fact is they have very little agency. Or, on the other hand, you could just make them passive. And she does neither. Again, very often by just using these domestic details, you'll often find a woman kind of working on a sampler which has some powerful resonance, some coat of arms that she is stitching that is a little bit against the Cromwell position. Some movement of her dress. These things to do with texture are crucial. And you see a kind of intelligence that's very particular to that female sphere. Refusing to eat is sometimes part of that when we see Mary in captivity. There's such kind of richness to the body language and to the power politics of refusing to take part in things.
Eyes that go to walls, part of it, isn't it? Where people look is fascinatingly revealing. So we're talking about this with the particular example, but I wonder if it's worth just broadening out to some of the wider implications, if there are any students listening to this who want to be able to think about third person versus first person, what they do. A lot of people writing not from within literary criticism tend to speak in very if you like, standardizing ways whereby the first person expresses subjectivity, it's internal, and the third person is out there, it's other, in one of the languages that gets sometimes used of it. But it's a very good example, this book, probably the best example we have in contemporary literature, of the mobility and practice of how pronouns work, of how placing person shifts according to the perspective, really, how it's written, what the interest is in, who else is being negotiated with. We don't have much you. There's a bit of it here in this passage, but you is sometimes seen to be intimate and ethical, whereas the third person is, again, out there and not really engaged with. But this is a fascinating piece of dynamic, dramatic thinking about what it means to be all those things in your own head. Sometimes I, sometimes you, sometimes he, this terrible he that's accruing weight in the course of these books.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that almost defines the novel as a form, isn't it? This ambiguity of speaker. I mean, you can go back to Jane Austen and the way in which that, you know, witty, omniscient narrator then suddenly focalizes down to the prejudices of a particular group within society, then to an individual protagonist. And I think it's something that quite often readers are not consciously aware of how that is working, but it's clearly setting the mood, it's setting your sense of how character works. And yet there is no straightforward difference in terms of kind of, I think, ethical function between first person and third person, but they're both capable of sustaining those ambiguities.
Right, and it is a difference, isn't it, also between the novel and drama. One of Emma Smith's recordings for this series talks about this from the other side, if you like, the drama side. You do have to think about where you are perspectivally inside a narrative, because it's in flux in a way that isn't on stage. On a stage, it's clear who's speaking. At any one time, the noise is going to be coming out of this mouth or that mouth. But in the novel, it's that room for doubt, which can be in other ways very, very mobile, asking you to think about whose interests are at work here, whose eyes are on it.
Yeah, and it's musical too. The whole way in which she's able to kind of switch between these, you know, very staccato exchanges to these languorous descriptions, which are not so much focalized on Cromwell, you know, descriptions of fog on the river or of, you know, the comfort of rooms. And then suddenly we see Cromwell kind of very clearly again with some gaze at, you know, particularly in the first book, we see a lot of his wool knowledge or something like that. And he's continually picking up on the way that kind of Thomas More's carpets are not quite as good as he thinks them.
Yeah. So, yeah. Creature comforts. Thank you. Enjoyed talking.
Thank you very much.